anybody that would ask him right now what he's doing is an idiot. Not a journalist. Is an absolute idiot.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
But that's okay. There's some players and coaches that are idiots too.
Any other questions for Coach Boeheim? Okay. Thank you, Coach.
Now, this is deeply scientific, this entire theory. Has this been looked at? I don't want to besmirch your background or anything like that, but real scientists, you know what I'm talking about. The people with all the letters after their names. Have they looked at your stuff, and what do they think of this?
Well, everyone who has looked at it found it interesting. Mm-hmm. And this is what scientists do. We find that interesting. We find that intriguing. You know, they're very conservative.
Right.
But I've not had any titled physicist be able to refute any aspect of this and say, well, this is absolutely wrong and this is why.
Right, right.
And, of course, we have a scientist in our field, in the paranormal field, whose name is David Rowntree. Who has actually conducted some very, very fascinating experiments that have validated some of the other predictions made by this model. So we're going to go into that in a moment. As I continue on speaking about this model and the kind of predictions it would make that we see at the site of paranormal events. If we have an expanding bubble of space-time, one of the things that we would see is that it would create a temporary vacuum inside of it. It would take a little bit for the surrounding material content, physical content, which would be the air, and the thermal energy that is held and contained in the air to seep into this opening and create an equilibrium, like water seeking its own level. This would be almost immeasurable if it happened very slowly, but if it happened quickly, so that the vacuum stood there for a moment, we would have a substantive vacuum, which means that it's a vacuum of substance. We'd also have a thermal vacuum. So one of the effects that we would predict by this model is the detection of a cold spot, seemingly out of midair, that appears and disappears. That's paranormal effect number 4.
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
No one has ever come up with any kind of a model to even connect 3 together, let alone 4. And now on the surface, based on conventional reasoning and observation, what I've mentioned so far seems to, on the surface, to be completely disassociated from one another. It's a complete mystery how one thing could be related with the other. Until this paradigm, when you look at this, it becomes very obvious how it's connected. So now we're going to go to paranormal effect number 5. And so far we've been talking about what I call secondary paranormal effects, which means measurable changes to the environment
right.
that must take place before information materializes within it.
See, like a precursor, kind of.
There you go. You got it.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm following along. I know you think I'm just like, I know you think I'm just passed out in my soup here, but I'm following along. Don't worry.
No. I know that you are. And you know, most people are able to follow it in the way that I'm talking about. Because it lays it out in a very logical and as easy to understand way as possible. So anyway, we talked about this vacuum of this quickly expanding bubble in space-time. Be almost like throwing open your front door on a cold winter's day and, you know, getting the inrush of cold and air. Because what we're also going to see is it's going to predict that we're going to measure drops in barometric pressure, which have also been experimentally confirmed, because there's a vacuum inside the bubble temporarily. If that bubble is big enough, if the bed is big enough and it expands quick enough, we're going to have a movement of air atoms of gases from the area of higher pressure to the area of lower pressure within. That's a fundamental function of wind. It works counterintuitively. We all conventionally think the wind blows, but it actually sucks. Because it's more scientifically accurate to say that vacuums draw volumes within themselves rather than to say volumes push themselves into vacuums. So the air is a wind is a function of air moving from an area of higher pressure to lower pressure. And that's an established meteorological principle. So this would produce a mystery breeze where there's no doors and windows open. Suddenly you get an inrushing of air. Just for a moment. Paranormal effect number 6. Let's go to paranormal effect number 7. It is very common for people to report a feeling of heaviness just at the onset of a paranormal effect, paranormal event. Well, now remember, we're talking about bending space. If we're to believe Einstein, that says that the bending of space is associated with gravity, we would predict the emergence of an additional gravitational field over and above that of the Earth's. And moreover, we would expect it to occur in all directions at the same time, not just a single line direction that points to the center of the Earth. We would see it, if we put it on a grid, we would see the emergence of this field on three axes. This is a, not only explains the feeling of heaviness, but this is one of the predictions that's unexpected. You know, it's not something that has been normally been measured or measured for. This scientist, David Rowntree, did such an experiment and demonstrated that at the onset of a paranormal event, that he detected a fluctuation in the gravitational field on three axes. That's deep, and that's very significant.
Okay, now let's sort of pull back a little bit from this, and I guess the question is, at the end of the day, you've got this theory, you can use it to do some predictive modeling, but what can we really do? But you also said, you know, you don't think anyone's ever going to be able to, like, capture a spirit. So, like, what can we really do with this other than possibly further understand why these things happen? Or not even why, but how these things happen.
Well, one of the things that could give us an understanding, you're asking about the practical exponents of this.
Right.
There's a lot of them, and they're quite amazing because it gives us a model of the universe where almost literally anything we can imagine we can accomplish. Let's talk about apparitions for a moment.
Okay.
Because I think before we're over, I'm going to touch on some other paranormal phenomena as well. But if an apparition is a materialization of an existing body of information that was also the same collection of information from which the original person was constructed,
mm-hmm.
that means that given the right conditions and the right understanding, that information can be fully materialized into a physical object. Now, it also means since apparitions dematerialize, it means that we can dematerialize an object and rematerialize it at another location from the same body of information that the original materialization came from. We're talking teleportation.
Yeah.
And bypassing the problems that we have looking at it conventionally, that we would have to have a supercomputer so strong that it would be able to record every piece of information from everything within the physical body and reassemble it from that physical information. And we already know that's not possible because of the quantum uncertainty effect, that we could never ascertain with certainty the quantum state of every single particle inside of a human body. But this method, we don't have to, because the information from which we could materialize it already exists. That's one thing we could do. Another thing that's possible is by bending of space, we could generate electromagnetic fields, which means limitless energy. You know, it's kind of like the zero point energy concept. It's actually what I think the zero point energy advocates are talking about is actually a veiled version of this effect that I'm talking about. Gosh, it's possible maybe the time travel with this. Just like the information from the 80-year-old lady, time travel to the current.
Right.
Imagine a bicycle wheel. And let's say the outside perimeter, the outside rim, the wheel itself, the tire and the rim, is normal space-time. And we have all these channels, these spokes, that enter into normal space-time, emerging from a center hub, which is a singularity. When you spin the tire, you see, if you're looking at the rim, you see velocity and you see dimension. You can actually measure it.
Right.
But if you're looking dead on at a perfectly centered hub, you see no movement at all. It stands still.
Right.
So let's say that hub is the source of this information. And let's say spoke A is 80 years ago. Well, you could take that information and push it down spoke B, for example, which is 80 years further on along the hub of the wheel. And you could have time travel.
Hmm.
Now.
Physical time travel or informational time travel?
Well, paranormal phenomena gives us the evidence that that information can be materialized from the past into the present.
Yeah. Okay.
So, theoretically, based on that model, it's possible. Another thing that we could do is that once we understand and assemble the wave functions that bend space, we can begin to manipulate them. So if you were able to collapse, to begin to collapse the space-time bubble surrounding an object, that object would begin to recede from what I call physical presence. It would begin to become transparent. It could even float because the effect of the Earth's gravity would be diminished because its presence in the dimensional realm has been reduced. It might even be able to pass through a wall. Sounds a lot like an apparition, doesn't it?
It sure does.
And so we could affect anti-gravity.
So we really need to be able to figure out how to harness this stuff.
Yeah, we first need to understand, we first need to work the mathematics and the science of the theoretical concept. And that's all I'm at right now. I'm not an engineer.
Right.
Nor am I a mathematician. So the work would have to be left to others. David Rowntree is a scientific engineer. He's been able to affect some of the tests to confirm this model. But others need to take up the mantle, so to speak. I liken my work to some of the fanciful drawings of Da Vinci, where he would draw flying machines, and he envisioned that they were possible, and he'd have an arrow, you know, to an open spot in the drawing that says unknown energy source.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so the other thing that influences time is, since time is linked to space, when you bend space, you bend time. So at the site of paranormal events, we should also be able to detect time fluctuations. And this is another experiment that David Rowntree has conducted and confirmed. And this is completely unanticipated and unexpected by any other theoretical model.
I'm surprised hearing all this that you know, this hasn't... Now, I know you've done the paranormal circuit, if you will, but I'm surprised that there aren't other people, like, picking this up. Again, in the mainstream. Because in order for this to really be... You know, for this to break through, it sort of needs to be, you know, looked at a university level. Then it could, maybe they'd be like, well, this is it. This is the answer to all this stuff.
Absolutely. And, you know? And I agree with you. And I'm unfortunately, what I've been trying to do is been promoting my work. Like any good author,
yeah,
you know, you have to sell books, you know, and this is what I'm trying to do. There's not a whole lot of talk shows that have a science theme. I've been on a few of them, and all have been very impressed. What's his name? Agnew? He does something X radio. I'd have to look it up.
Yeah, I don't know.
He has a physics degree. Very, very impressed with what I had to say. In fact, during the interview, I actually corrected him on a couple of inaccuracies that he was talking about. Dr. John DeSalvo has physics in his background. He found it very fascinating. But in order to submit something like this to the scientific community, to write a scientific paper, we have to have certain experimental correlations. And it has to be recorded in that kind of a way so that it can be presented to the scientific community. This other gentleman, Roundtree, and myself have a lot of what is necessary. There's more work that needs to be done. But the two of us are in a unique position for the first time in history to ultimately be able to assemble a scientific paper to submit to the community on paranormal phenomena.
Well, that's what we need, man. That's the end game, right?
It's the beginning.
It's there you go. It's the end of the beginning, right?
Yeah, you know, pretty much, the Industrial Revolution was the beginning. Everything that came before that, you know, with the ox-drawn wheels and everything, is a different era. So, yeah, it's a beginning.
So what other paranormal, we've talked a lot here about the ghosts and spirits and stuff like that, and what other, you know, paranormal phenomena do you think can be applied to this scenario?
Okay, let's talk a little bit now about primary paranormal phenomena.
Okay.
I distinguish it from the secondary because the secondary are all the observations that have to do with the changes that take place in the local environment prior to the materialization of information in local space, which is the primary effect. Let's talk about something that gets a lot of buzz, a lot of press, EVPs. Electronic voice phenomena.
That's right, yeah.
All right. Let's go back to our bubble. Now, when information materializes within a space-time bubble, that bubble conforms itself to the geometry of the materialized information. So, for example, you and I, we have a warping of space-time around us that is shaped identically to our physical geometry. It's not a round bubble that we live inside. You know, the bubble is shaped exactly to our geometric configuration.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have this round bubble, this spirit orb, so to speak, or what some paranormal investigators have said, observed after hearing my theory, that it perfectly describes what they call a spirit portal, where spirits come through. Kind of interesting, because it works that very same way that they think it works, but speaking of it on a spiritual or metaphysical way. let's talk about voices, for example, paranormal voices as a collection of information, coherent information.
Right.
When that information, imagine my model earlier that instead of somebody pushing a quarter through the rubber membrane, that somebody's talking into it, and there's a bubble there, and that information is materializing inside that bubble. Well, the second it begins to materialize, that information is going to give out frequency. It's going to give out oscillations that will be reflected on the outside of the bubble. The bubble itself will begin to conform and vibrate in frequency and amplitude to the materializing information. And once that happens, what we've got now is we've got this vibrating bubble sitting in the middle of space that is connected to the air. And so it begins to oscillate the air and acts like a vocal cord. And so people hear the vibration in the air coming off the surface of the bubble in their ear, and they hear a voice coming out of thin air. Because the actual substance of space-time is acting as a loudspeaker.
Hmm.
Oh, by the way, that's phenomenon number 8.
For those keeping score at home. Now, how long have you been working on this? You've been studying all this for like 30 years. Is this the culmination of a 30-year process to figure this all out? Or is this something that you kind of stumbled upon recently, like, you know, maybe in the last 5 years or something?
The concept, the real broad concept that, you know, both information and substance was originating from outside of space-time. And the general view, the general gist of what mechanism was evolved kind of came on early in my research. It took me all these years not only to assemble the right body of information, the right collection of data and evidence to present and to compare that model to other phenomena and see how it addresses it, but also, believe it or not, to reduce it into understandable language. I can't tell you how many times I rewrote this book until I got it in a way so that what I call, my goal was so that the average person with average intelligence, but with an above average interest in the subject, would be able to understand it and grasp it. That took quite a while. And then, of course, at some point, you just have to pull the trigger and say, you know, this is good enough.
Right.
And that's what I did, you know, in August of 2011 when I published. This is good enough. And that's when I put the work out.
In your information packet that you sent me, it said you've been invited on or done 200 shows.
Oh, my. Yeah.
Do you ever get tired? I don't know if I can do 200 shows on the same thing all the time. I think I would go a little out of my head. Do you mind that? Or I guess it's part of your passion to spread the word about this theory.
It's what I need to do.
Yeah.
This is an important story, so to speak.
It could be a game changer if it all works.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's a story that has to be told. And there's no living person that can tell it the way I can. So that's part of it. Part of it is, you know, to pay the bills, you know, to sell books, so that people would share this. You know, I had somebody ask me, well, why don't you publish your work? I said, I already did. You know, anybody can pick it up. Scientists once pick it up and read it, let them read it. You know?
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, like they're saying, why don't you publish it like in a scientific journal or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Although to publish a real scientific paper, you know, I have to do some more work, obviously, as I talked about.
Right.
But, you know, the fundamental concepts are there, and they address a lot of different issues, some very important issues. Oh, by the way, let me mention one other thing.
Mm-hmm.
With the paranormal phenomena, let's leave it at an even 10.
There you
I
go.
Guess. At a lower energy level, this materializing vocalization that oscillates the surface of the space-time bubble. Remember I said this bubble's jacketed in an electromagnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
So it would emit electromagnetic compression waves of a specific frequency and amplitude. Now, they're not acoustic waves at this energy level. They're just electromagnetic waves. But they project out, they reach a recording microphone. Now, dynamic microphone, which is the only kind of microphone that really picks up EVPs, it's made with an acoustic diaphragm that's connected to a copper coil and it moves the coil back and forth as the diaphragm moves. And the coil passes through an electro or a magnet that surrounds the coil. And that's what creates the electromagnetic compression wave of the precise frequency and amplitude so that the electronic device, the recorder, can play it back as an audible voice. That's how a dynamic microphone works.
Right.
In this case, what we're doing is we already have an oscillating field at the correct frequency and amplitude. That electromagnetic field bypasses the acoustic diaphragm, doesn't affect it at all, but induces itself directly on the copper coils. It doesn't need to move the coils, and it doesn't, because the compression wave is already induced in the coils. The coils send the wave into the device. It translates it into an audible voice, and we hear a recording of a voice where no one present acoustically heard it.
Hmm.
That's an EVP. This has already been demonstrated. In fact, Roundtree demonstrated, proved this some years ago, that EVPs are electromagnetic phenomena. They are not acoustic. One of the predictions, two of the predictions that this model made, was that we should be able to record EVPs in a vacuum, where the microphone itself is in a vacuum. And we should be able to record EVPs with the diaphragm of the microphone surgically removed, like with an X-Acto knife. And David Roundtree conducted both of these experiments years ago and confirmed that this prediction actually takes place. Very interesting. Early last year, I had an interview booked with a woman on a paranormal show who was very much into the psychic end of it. So much so that when she heard what I had to say in a preliminary phone call, she said, look, I'm completely unqualified to conduct this interview. I have a friend of mine that's really into the scientific end. Let me bring him on as a co-guest or a co-host.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this man, David Roundtree. I had never heard of David Roundtree's work, and he had never heard of mine. I was only, this was in February of last year. I'd only begun promotions back in November of 2011. So I'd only been on the scene a few months. Most of the characters, the personalities in these fields, I knew nothing of. So he came on the show, and he shared with me later that he had kind of an attitude. He was going to come on and debunk me. Heard all these people talk about, quote-unquote scientific approaches to the paranormal, and essentially it turned out like what they were doing was like a tourist running around the countryside with a highly sophisticated digital movie camera.
Right, right, yeah.
You know, that's not conducting science, although you're using a scientific instrument. But when I started talking and telling them that this theory predicts we should find this, this theory predicts we should find this, you know, he kept saying, I conducted that experiment, and that's what I found.
So you debunked him.
Yeah, he was stunned. After going through about a half a dozen or so of these, he'd never heard anything like it before. And his experiments have confirmed this model. The gravitational fluctuation was detected very cleverly. And this is one of Roundtree's brilliances of coming up with devices and equipment that you can make very inexpensively or relatively inexpensively. I always talked about coming up with some sort of a gravimeter that would be an enclosed, a sphere, enclosed in a larger sphere and suspended with some sort of elastic, so that when the bend of space occurs, we would be able to detect the movement of that ball, suspended ball inside. What Roundtree did was this. He reasoned, since he's very familiar with electronic equipment, he understood that things like the iPads and the iPhones and the iTouches, they already have a gyroscope in them. So when you rotate the device...
Oh, the screen flips, yeah.
Screen stays level, you know.
Yeah.
It stays perpendicular, parallel to the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
So he put several of these together and programmed them. And when they were anchored dead still... and he was able to, at the recording of an EVP, he could see the movement of this gyroscope synchronized in all three of these devices, which means that we were having a gravitational fluctuation on three axes.
Yeah.
You know, the emergence of a completely different gravitational field than that of the Earth. And so he was just floored, and so was I.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I wanted to crawl through the phone wire and kiss him. You know, I said, here's a guy, I found this guy that's conducted all these experiments that I envisioned and did them in ways that I could not possibly have envisioned.
Right, right.
He set up another device, and this he had done prior to our, knowing each other, that measured the rate of the movement of particles between two receivers. And it was set up in such a way that it would create a pitch. And, of course, they travel through space at a given rate. But if you bend the space between those 2 meters, you add a curve to it, the speed of the particle stays the same, but it has to cover a greater distance because now you've bent the road instead of having a straight road. Even though the car is traveling at the same speed, it takes longer to get back and forth between the two receivers.
Right, right.
And so you would hear a drop in a pitch. And he found that also.
Remarkable. Let's go in a little bit of a different direction, though. Let me ask you,
okay.
you said that you are, let me get the right wording here. You're focused more on the forensics rather than the criminology.
Correct.
Of the paranormal. Let's talk a little bit, though, about the criminology part of it. You have to have theories and thoughts and beliefs about what is behind all of this.
Well, you know, here's what I look at. Again, I try to take it from a cosmological viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's very unusual, but most of the time when people hear what I say, wow, that makes sense. You know, let's start by looking at the universe as a system. Now, in physics, in science, chemistry, any aspect of that, when we study a system, the first thing we have to do is come up with a set of principles and laws and parameters that define and establish and characterize the system that we're studying. So let's look at the universe as a system, and it has laws and principles that establish and govern and describe it. Not that we're familiar with all of them. We know some of them. Now, that means the next step in that principle is that any subsystem of that system cannot behave in a way that is contrary to or outside of the greater system in which it is a subset. You know,
mm-hmm.
You're not going to build an internal combustion engine and have it spit giraffes out of the tailpipe.
Exactly, yeah.
That's not going to happen. You have a given set of a system when you put your Thanksgiving turkey in the oven. You're not going to open it up 3 hours later and find a Wankel rotary engine.
Yeah.
Okay? It's more complex than that, but that's a good idea. So, now let's take a look at the human brain. The human brain is a subset of the universe. That means that the human brain cannot operate in a way that is contrary to or outside of the laws and principles that govern the greater system in which it is a component. Now, scientists don't normally like to look at it this way because it drags physicists into a place where here be monsters. And they just don't want to go there. But I could take a scientist and drag them by force to the table and make them sit there by using science's own principles, which is what needs to be done to get science to look at these things seriously. You got to go into their ring on their home turf, in their arena, with their home field advantage and home audience and their home rules,
yeah,
and give them a bloody nose on their own turf. And that's what I've been able to do with this model. But anyway, to get back to what I was saying with the brain, if the brain is a subset of the greater universe, well, we know that the brain is intelligent. We understand that.
Mm-hmm.
That means that intelligence has to be built into the laws and principles of the universe. That means the universe itself must be intelligent. Otherwise, we would have to confess that the universe gave rise to a subset that exceeded or contradicted the laws and principles by which the universe itself is put together.
Hmm.
And that logic is indisputable.
Right.
I'm surprised that no one's ever used it before.
Well, I'm surprised that a lot of the stuff you're putting out there hasn't been picked up or, I mean, like, kudos to you for sort of putting this all together. I'm surprised it's taken so long for it to be put together.
It's like a paradigm. This is what I talk about. If you'd notice, Tim, throughout our conversation, other than maybe the idea about gravity, that concept,
mm-hmm.
And how that works together in making some of these predictions and describing the nature of the universe, almost nothing that I mentioned is new. Everything that I'm talking about, for the most part, has been either established findings or, you know, philosophical thoughts that have been around for a long time. The difference is the paradigm. It's like I was saying up front with the information being a fundamental paradigm of the universe. It's a way of looking at it. For many centuries, we understood what the effects were of earthquakes. We understood perfectly what the effects of volcanoes were. We could observe them, and we could describe them. We know it was hot, know the earth shakes, all those kinds of things.
Right.
Just like in a paranormal location where we've recorded the effects very well. We know what the effects are. But the causes behind them were just speculative. Some of the greatest minds in those fields applied themselves to that and couldn't come up with an answer of what was causing them exactly. What was the mechanism? Until the concept, the paradigm of plate tectonics came into existence and continental drift.
Mm.
And that was around the late 50s. It was first introduced in the 30s and was ignored because it was a scientific paper. It was introduced later by Emanuel Velikovsky in his controversial book, Worlds in Collision.
Yeah.
And they crucified him.
Oh, they're still, they're digging him up and crucifying him all the time still.
Oh, yeah, man. How many times can you kill a guy, you know? It's like watching the Magruder film, seeing Kennedy get assassinated 1,000 times, you know?
Exactly.
Well,
that's another point, though. Do you think that this, your theory is kind of radical in a lot of ways. I mean, you think that it would certainly upset the apple cart of mainstream science. Do you think that there is resistance, will be resistance, has been resistance to the idea? Like I said, maybe you're not the first guy to come up with this, but other people have thrown it out there and had it shot down sort of behind this, you know, papers rejected and that kind of thing.
Yeah. The resistance, and what I wanted to mention, I just wanted to finish that thought.
I'm sorry, yeah.
Drift. It's okay. Now, once we looked at all of those effects through the eyes of that paradigm, suddenly the veil was lifted. And we could understand perfectly not only how earthquakes occurred and how volcanoes occurred, but that we also understood that for the first time that the mechanism was the same. And moreover, we discovered something new that we had no idea before by looking at the outward effects. That the formation of mountains were the result of the same mechanism.
Right.
And it wasn't the increase, Tim, of additional data. It was just that new way of looking at things. And now, a young school child could explain to you the basics of plate tectonics.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, where the greatest geniuses in the world in decades past without that paradigm couldn't figure it out. So, you know, this is what my theory does. It gives us a new paradigm. And when we look at it through that lens, suddenly all kinds of things begin to pop up. You know, from the scientific point of view, we have to understand that the philosophy, the predominant philosophy of mainstream physics today is one of materialism. We talked about that before.
Mm-hmm.
Every material effect must have a material cause contained locally in the same universe. The problem is, in recent years, that we've been running out of causes for all the effects that we observe. We literally have run out of material causes to explain all the effects that we see. So what science has reverted to is making up imaginary substances, imaginary material. Now, one of the substances that they've made up that most people know of is dark matter.
Right.
You know, this is this substance. The problem is that through our powers of observation, they've become so keen through our instrumentation that we now understand that close to 90% of the gravitational effect that we see in the universe has no adjacent physical mass as a cause. You know, that's paranormal because it's an effect without a physical cause connected to it. Calusa said this was non-local, but according to the predominant material paradigm in physics, it can't be non-local. So they have to make up this imaginary mass called dark matter. Now, one of the predictions that my theory makes is that there's no such thing as dark matter. And funny, earlier last year, about mid part of the year,
yeah,
they finished a couple year study where astrophysicists surveyed our local region of space, our solar system, and the stars that are in a handful of light years around us. And when they added everything up, there was no room for dark matter. They found no evidence of the existence of dark matter. And yet, it's still talked about as if it's real. So that was a prediction that my model made that was proved. Another prediction my model makes is that there's no such thing as supersymmetry. Now, this is an odd thing. It gets a little esoteric, but just on the idea is that every particle has a heavier supersymmetrical twin.
Mm-hmm.
And that the Large Hadron Collider was supposed to discover these supersymmetrical particles. One of the first things that it was supposed to do, because it operates at the higher energy levels necessary to detect these things. They haven't found anything. In fact, just recently they came up with a report that based on the results they're getting from the LHC, that they're now thinking that there is no such thing as supersymmetry. Where all of established physics has believed in this for 50 years. And my model predicts that there's no such thing. And I put myself on the line and said it in interviews. It doesn't exist. It's not real. And people look at me like a quack because they say, what's this guy saying? He's saying opposite of all these well-established and well-known physicists, you know.
Yeah.
Like I can debunk a lot of the stuff that Dr. Kaku talks about. You know, the Oriental guy starts talking about multiverses and dinosaurs.
Asian, you mean.
You know, I could bury that guy.
Well, we don't have that much time left, so let's.
But anyway, you know, and I don't want to sound aggressive, you know, and.
No, it's all right. I understand. You're dealing with a, you know, you think you got this great theory, and you really want these people to really look at it, give it a fair shake, and it sounds like that it's going to take some time for it to really take root. I mean, there's a possibility that all the pieces of your theory may come together and, you know, sometime down the line they may look back and be like, well, that Fusco guy got it right, like in the late, you know, in 2011, you know, but now, uh-huh. You know what I'm saying?
One of the characteristics of a good theory, and this is part of the scientific method, that, again, that lay people are not familiar with and many paranormal investigators that, you know, say they invest things scientifically. If you ask them to describe the scientific method, they can't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so one of the things that takes place is that you have a hypothesis and then you pose questions to it. And if that hypothesis answers the pertinent questions placed to it better than any other system that exists, then it becomes a bona fide theory. And this is what this theory does. It answers very, you know, serious and dramatic questions in a consistent way. That's the other criteria, that it doesn't have to make exceptions to its own rules for certain anomalous data. You know, and so then the next part to make it a scientific theory is to make predictions that can be experimentally testable.
Right.
So I've got them not only in the paranormal, but it's made predictions on a cosmological scale that scientists have already begun to confirm these predictions, even though they don't know the prediction exists yet.
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. You know, it's like down the line, the physics may change and, you know, they'll look back and someone hopefully will give you the credit if it turns out that this is all, you know, all adds up.
Well, if I submit a paper, and there's, like I said, there's a lot of work that I need to do. There's a lot of mathematics. I need a damned good engineer. I need a theoretical physicist that is well-versed in relativity and Kaluza-Klein theory. And I need a damned good mathematician that has experience in theoretical physics. If I could put that team together, I could submit a scientific paper.
All right. Unfortunately, I'm not qualified for any of those jobs.
I understand. I'm hoping at some point in the near future that this message will fall on the right ears.
All right. Well, you get a lot of listeners right now, and I figure that there's a good group of people out there right now listening to this who are very intrigued by this theory, and I suggest they pick up the book. They got to get it through your website, though. That's the best place to get it, right?
That's the best way. It's available to a lot of online booksellers, Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com. But the best price, if you go to my website, www.cosmicveil.com, we have a direct link with our distributor, we have a promotional code. If you enter that code, you'll get the best price on the internet anywhere on the book.
Nice, nice. And that helps you out more than if it goes through Amazon anyway, right? So.
Oh, Amazon's murder, man, I'll tell you. But we, you know, Amazon and Barnes & Noble and their non-competitive way of handling electronic books is the reason why this book is not yet available in electronic format. I said Amazon and Barnes & Noble have a certain kind of an artificial way of manipulating the electronic book market. And it's a very non-competitive way that they present to to authors with a certain kinds of books like mine.
Ah.
Makes it very uncompetitive, which is the main reason why my book hasn't been released in electronic format yet.
Do you think it's like, you mean books like yours as in paranormal, esoteric books?
Books like mine that are over 400 pages.
Ah, okay.
A certain expense to print them and ship them. And so you have to charge a certain amount of price.
Mm.
And if you charge the right kind of price, for the electronic version so that you don't kill your business on the printed version.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So in other words, what you do is you hang yourself by running your own competition by pricing the book in a way that Amazon and Barnes & Noble make it profitable. If you price it to be competitive, they hit you with half of the royalties. They take half your royalties away. And so it's very odd. Somebody wrote a little chintzy book that cost $2 to print.
Yeah.
You know, and they sell it for $10. They'll actually make more money selling the electronic version for $10. But if you have a book that mine costs, it lists for like $33. It's very uncompetitive, and it's to publish it in electronic form.
Yeah. Well, that's disappointing. Well, it's a new industry. They'll figure it out.
Oh, yeah. Or the courts will figure it out for them.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, you talk about putting together this team. What's next for you? More sort of finding ways to prove this thing via predicted models?
Well, certainly that's part of it, is constructing new experiments. But right now, I think that we have enough that if we were able to sit down and work out the mathematics of this, that it would be sufficient to publish a paper. More predictive experiments would be better. There's a couple I have in mind that we could perform at paranormal sites because, you know, this is what my associate Roundtree says. He says one of the reasons why physics has not been able to come up with a workable theory of everything is because they ignore supernatural phenomena. Any theory of everything would have to incorporate paranormal and supernatural phenomena in order to be a workable theory that would actually function and all the math would balance and everything would work right.
Isn't the opposite point on that, that if they came up with a theory of everything that it would explain the paranormal?
Well, yeah, that's saying the same thing.
Okay.
You know, but since they ignore that body of data, you know, they'll never come up with it.
Right.
A lot of the strange theories that you hear about, like string theory, which is very convoluted, doesn't quite work because, in my opinion, what they're trying to do is to describe a system that has both physical and superphysical attributes, confining it to a physical model. So you get all these weird things where they come up with 23 mathematical dimensions, but since they have no superphysical extension of the four dimensions, they have to explain how somehow those dimensions are folded up within four dimensions in a way that they can't be observed, just like dark matter can't be observed.
Mm.
So the other thing that most people, here's a good bone for the layperson. Got a couple of good ones. You know, the things that scientists don't tell you, they don't tell the public. One of the things is that all string theory is dependent upon the assumption that there exists a graviton. If a graviton doesn't exist, all string theory collapses.
Hmm.
Yep. It falls prey to what Einstein called, and I call it an Einsteinian principle, of unnecessary complexity. You know, Einstein didn't believe that the final theory would be complex. It would be a simple concept,
right,
like what I'm talking about. Another, you know, trade secret. You remember last year they made this big hullabaloo about discovering the Higgs boson.
Oh, yeah.
But when you read the quality articles, you know, they had, what's his name, Peter Higgs weeping openly at the all that. Oh, my gosh. You know, I thought I was watching, I don't know, you know.
Days of Our Lives?
Oh, some reality show, you know. You know, all the drama aside, if you read the quality scientifically based articles on this, you'll find out that they didn't come out and quite say they found a Higgs boson. They can't call it the Higgs boson. They say we found a boson within the range of 125 giga electron volts of mass. But they can't call the Higgs boson because there's problems with that. They discovered something, but it's not a Higgs boson.
Right.
And one of the problems is that the Higgs model describes a field that has a value of infinity. Can't happen.
Yeah, that's what you were saying earlier, yeah.
Material paradigm. So what did they do? They assumed that the modifier that would bring that mathematical value down into physical reality was going to be the Higgs supersymmetrical particle. Well, now all the evidence shows that there is no such thing. because they should have found it before they found the Higgs boson.
Right.
So here they are, you know, basically holding an empty bag in a way. There's something in it. But this is not something that you will hear, you know, in the public news. Because it's not sensational. It causes you to have to think, to have knowledge, you know, and that hurts. My brain hurts.
Well, my brain's starting to hurt now after this conversation. I'm going to have to think long and hard about these theories and really how they apply to the world around us. And I think the listeners are really going to enjoy this conversation.
Well, I'm very happy to be here, and I'm thankful. I thank you for inviting me and allowing me to share this with your audience, and I had a great time.
I did too. I really enjoyed it quite a bit. It was an education for me, and has me, like I said, looking at the world from a different angle. This is a very exciting theory, and if it all comes together, it could be an exciting future as well.
It definitely leaves the door open that we could probably do anything that we can imagine.
Well, on that note, thank you, Thomas, for coming on the show. Folks, the website is cosmicveil.com, V-E-I-L. Check it out. Find out more about this theory and this model of the universe, and it very well may be the future fabric of the universe as time goes on. So I think you're really on the bleeding edge of new science, my friend, and I'm looking forward to seeing further developments, and please keep us posted. And thank you very much, sir, for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me.
That does it for this edition of BOA Audio Season 7. Big, big thanks to Thomas Fusco for coming on the show. To follow his work, check out his website, www.cosmicveil.com. Pretty simple, all one word, cosmicveil.com. And be sure to check out his book, Behind the Cosmic Veil. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA Audio Listener Feedback. And since we skipped feedback last week, we've got quite a few emails to get to, and they're covering a whole bunch of different previous episodes. So let's dive on in. The first one comes from USofE.com poster G-Wiz, who had a post in the thread for our episode featuring Artie Sixkiller Clark, and here's what G-Wiz has to say. Another great episode. Thank you, Tim and Artie. It was interesting to hear indigenous peoples tell of their experience in a very matter-of-fact way. The only other account I've heard of where an entity tries to take a dog was, I believe, in an old UFO book titled UFO Occupants by Jim and Coral Lorenzen. They recounted a tale of a Texas farm boy who saw some being attempting to grab his dog. They in turn said, "We mean you no harm. We only want your dog." The lad in turn told them, "Go to hell." Upon hearing this, they immediately jumped back into their vehicle and took off. A weird and unnerving account. In any event, thanks again, Tim, for all you do in providing different guests, different perspectives, and, as usual, great questions. Gee whiz. Thank you very much for your post on the BOA forum, G-Wiz. Much appreciated. I don't have too much to say about this, except that I wanted to highlight the story that G-Wiz dug up here about the ETs or entities trying to take the Texas boy's dog, because I was really blown away by that when I talked to Artie Sixkiller Clark and couldn't recall any other previous tale that was similar. Thankfully, G-Wiz did recall such a tale, and I guess we'll kind of put it out here to the listeners. If you've got other stories of animals and aliens, I would love to hear them. I would love to know if there's anyone out there who's written about animals and aliens, or even other paranormal phenomena and animals, because I think that's a fascinating area that is totally worthy of investigation. And I have a feeling that we've only really scratched the very tip of the iceberg when it comes to that potential avenue of research. So send me your stories if you've got them, or direct me to the stories if they can be found online or in book form. It would be much appreciated. Next email comes from Michael, who is writing regarding the John Rhodes interview, and here's what he has to say. I fall asleep listening to your show every night. This past show was a joke. Your guest said birds are warm-blooded. I'm very interested in the humanoid-reptoid theory, but this guy was a joke. Sorry, I just really felt the need to write you and to you this. You're amazing. Night. Signed, Michael. Then he quickly followed up with the subsequent email which says, Sorry, I'm a little tipsy. Hope my last email made sense. Despite your feelings on the John Rhodes interview, Michael, thank you very much for writing in. Most of your email made sense, except for the part where you say that you felt the need to write you and to you this. But maybe I'm just misinterpreting it. Nonetheless, I totally understand. We've addressed the whole birds are mammals thing, which we covered in previous BOA audio listener feedback segments. So there's no point in belaboring that. I haven't reached out to John Rhodes to find out what he meant by that and if it was just a misstep on his part, which I'm willing to bet it was. But there's really no point in rehashing all of that. But I appreciate the feedback. And as I said, I'm always interested in hearing what people think, even if they hated the guests. That's perfectly fine. Before I let you go, Michael, I will say this. I'm going to give you some words of wisdom. Nothing good can come from a tipsy email. Trust me. Trust me, Michael. If you're feeling tipsy, step away from the computer. Put the phone down. Close up the iPad. Go and have another beer. And then hopefully pass out. Because only bad things can come from tipsy emails. That's my advice for you, my friend. Trust me on this. I know from experience. And no, I will not extrapolate on that. Next email comes from Glenn. No hometown listed. Here's what he has to say. I was listening to the Coleman Rux interview about the Aurora shooting, and Bruce Rux asked about why the shooter did what he did, and laid out how he had been published in some of the more prestigious journals, and etc. And I got to thinking. I recently told someone about the dead scientist that Stephen Quayle talks about. What if this whole thing was just a way to get rid of someone who would have made some significant advances in his field? My thought, what if this was a more public way to get this future scientific mover and shaker out of the way? Glenn. Thank you very much for writing in, Glenn. As noted, we're digging into the mailbag and clearing out some of these correspondences which came from previous episodes, and I wanted to talk about this one because I thought it was pretty interesting. I appreciate that you have given this some thought, Glenn, and actually sort of put together a conspiracy theory that is enchanting with regards to James Holmes and the Aurora shooting, but I cannot get on board with this one for the simple reason that if the powers that be, if you will, really wanted to silence James Holmes and take him out, I think they would just have him die in some kind of mysterious quote-unquote accident, or he would be, as the conspiracy theorists like to say, suicided. Certainly he would have been killed on the scene of the Aurora shooting. I don't think he would have lived through that if it was part of some elaborate plan to silence him. So I'm going to have to put this one beyond the gray basket. I'm going to have to put this one into my very skeptical basket, simply because it just does not add up as far as what the motivation would be, which is to silence him, or knock him off, or get him out of the way, because he's still around. He has a larger platform now than he ever had before. So if he had something to say that would shock the world, I have a feeling he would say it, or he will say it in the future, and that goes against the whole idea of silencing him. So I am skeptical, but I really do love the theory and appreciate you sending it in. Next email comes from Jeremy in Oakland, who wrote to us on the Banal of America Facebook page. He says, Wow, just came across this podcast looking for shadow people, because my usual podcasts have been having way too many psychics. I think this is my new favorite. Need to spread the word and get you some more likes. Thanks for the entertainment. Jeremy in Oakland. Thank you very much, Jeremy, for writing in. I have nothing really to say to that except that we do not have psychics on the program. Given how dated some of these interviews are by the time they arrive in your earbuds, it is completely antithetical for us to even interview psychics. And the only way I would ever have a psychic on the show is if somehow they proved to me that they were personally psychic, and then we could really kind of get into their abilities. So if there are any real psychics out there, contact me with some insights that only I would be able to confirm, and maybe we'll have you on the show. But since Jeremy doesn't like psychics on shows, and probably the BOA audio listeners don't either, it's kind of unlikely. And thank you for spreading the word about the show, Jeremy, and thank you for trying to get us more likes. We are up to 963 likes at the Banal of America Facebook page. After this edition of the program, there are 5 episodes left here in Season 7, so let's make that our goal. Let's get to 1,000 by the season finale of BOA Audio Season 7. I have a feeling we can do it. I know we can do it, so let's do it. I'm in a very strange mood tonight. I think it's from putting out 2 episodes in 1 week. But I think that will wrap up the mailbag here this week. We've covered a whole bunch of different episodes. I would have loved to have featured more feedback on the David Weatherly episode, which we just posted last week, covering black-eyed kids. And I probably will try and tackle those on the next edition of the program. But most of them are really just one-liners by people saying just how creeped out they were by the episode. It was definitely one of the creepiest programs we put out in quite some time, and that was certainly reflected in the feedback. And if I had time right now, I would dig through these one-liners and read them to you, because they are funny and also very chilling as well. So maybe we'll put that on tap for the next installment of listener feedback. Speaking of the next installment of listener feedback, if you'd like to be a part of that or future segments in future episodes of the program, there are a number of ways to reach me. You can write to boaaudio@hotmail.com, or just head on over to banalofamerica.com and click the contact button. If you want a little more interactive experience, you can join up at the official BOA forum, the US of e.com, theusofe.com, or just click the forum button at Banal of America. It is BOA's paranormal playground, theusofe.com. Head on over and check it out, my friends. Additionally, I am on Facebook and Twitter, so feel free to punch in Banal, B-I-N-N-A-L-L. That'll bring up my profile. Feel free to befriend me, follow me, or poke me. It's all good, and I'd be happy to have you as part of my online circle of friends. And finally, of course, we plugged Banal of America on Facebook. No need to rehash that. Just punch in Banal of America on Facebook, and that'll bring up the page. We're at 963 likes. We're trying to get to 1,000 by the season finale. We've got 5 episodes left to do it. I am very confident we will do so. And, of course, the 1,000th like will get a shout-out here at the end of the program, and most likely a handful of others will as well when we get hovering around that big number. No matter how you choose to get in touch with me, if you have something to say about the program, positive or negative, constructive criticism, or suggestions for future episodes, please do so. I read all the emails, all the correspondences I get. I check Facebook, I check Twitter, I check it all, and I try to get back to everybody as soon as possible. Sometimes it takes a while, but I do get back to everybody. So please, if you have something to say, send me your thoughts. I'd love to hear them. Up next, let's take a moment and thank the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff, Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, our webmaster, Ray Weigel, and our graphics guru, Jeremy Boston. BOA 3.0 is churning along, and hopefully in the not too distant future, you will be able to feast your eyes on the new layout for Banal of America, and I think folks will really dig it. I have seen an early draft of the page. I am really excited about the direction that it is going. So stay tuned to banalofamerica.com because you never know when BOA 3.0 will launch. Now comes the time in the program where I take my hat off and pass it around to the BOA audio listeners and ask you to help us out here at Banal of America. I already did a hard sell on this at the end of the baseball special, but since that only reaches a fraction of the audience, I want to really do another hard sell here to the general BOA audio listeners. Essentially, the gist of it is, in about 10 days, I am going to get crushed by the tax man. My taxes are brutal this year, the worst they've really ever been, and they're going to leave me really in some rough financial shape here as we kick off the spring. So I'm turning to the BOA audio listeners, the folks who have supported us for so very long, and ask you to please make a donation to the Banal of America franchise and keep us in the black. How do you do that? That's simple. You can head on over to banalofamerica.com and click the PayPal button. That'll bring you to PayPal. They'll walk you through the process. It's safe, secure, and simple. But if you don't trust the internet and you still want to help us out, you can send off a donation to Tim Banal, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. And you can find the complete address at Banal of America under the PayPal button. As always, it goes without saying, my friends, that no donation is too small, and all donations go towards Banal of America and BOA Audio to help keep the entire franchise up and running, freely available, and commercial free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. On the next edition of BOA Audio, we are going to go underground, literally, my friends, as we welcome our guest, William Michael Mott, author of the book Caverns, Cauldrons, and Concealed Creatures. That really is the definitive book on the potential race of creatures, entities, whatever you want to call them, existing beneath the surface of the planet. Michael Mott is not a hollow earth theorist, but he believes in a veritable honeycombed earth, which contains all sorts of strange and troubling entities, and we're going to explore it in depth on the next edition of the program. This was a guest suggestion from one of the BOA audio listeners, and they did a tremendous job in suggesting William Michael Mott. It was a fantastic conversation. I think it's going to be a BOA audio classic because we went down all sorts of different roads that I never expected to even be delving into, and really kind of threw the notes out early on this one. It turned into a jam session, which almost never happens with a first-time guest, but we really just clicked in a big way, William Michael Mott and I. So we spend really the first half hour talking about the state of the paranormal, and then we get into caverns, cauldrons, and concealed creatures, and it is really a wild, wild ride. I think folks are going to really dig this edition of the program. William Michael Mott talking about caverns, cauldrons, and concealed creatures on the next edition of BOA Audio. And on that note, we close the book on this edition of BOA Audio. Big, big thanks to Thomas Fusco for coming on the show. Big thanks to G-Wiz, Michael, Glenn, and Jeremy for their contributions to BOA Audio Listener Feedback, and, of course, enormous thanks to all you folks out there, the hardcore BOA Audio listeners. Thank you once again for your enduring support of this program. It is truly humbling and appreciated. Thank you once again for making BOA Audio a part of your Esoteric Audio Playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.